I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and she's been on the front lines of the battle trying to teach people about vaccines for a long time. Wrote a wonderful article I enjoyed this last week on the influenza vaccine, but she's also right up on this whole situation as far as the bird flu is concerned. And of course, we're hearing a tremendous amount of information on the bird flu. We're told it's not a matter of if, but when it's going to strike. And yet, is it really going to strike? We have a pandemic. We have a bird flu pandemic, but it's a bird pandemic. It's not affecting people throughout the country, so, and certainly not throughout the world. 110 people have died. What is this all about? Dr. Tenpenny, thank you so very much for being with us.
Good evening, Stan, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, why don't you tell us, you went to one of these big conferences, didn't you?
I did. I went to the National Bird Flu Summit, the first National Bird Flu Summit in Washington, D.C., February 28th and 29th. I'm scheduled to go again to the second Bird Flu Summit in Washington on June 27th and 28th, something like that. I don't think that much was said there that hasn't already been, you probably haven't already said, and hasn't already been said in the news. But the thing that came up repeatedly that I heard there was when the heads of the World Health Organization, the OIE, the WHO, all of those organizations saying things like, when the bird flu arrives, not if, but when, which certainly made me wonder what they know that we don't know.
And that would be the one thing that, I mean, if you look at it logically, there's no reason to think that it's going to suddenly, you know, jump its the barriers of what it is today and go human to be human unless they already have genetically engineered this.
Well, I keep hearing that over and over again. I think that there is probably some more elements to it than just simply that. But it's interesting, because how can you plan for a random event? But yet we've spent millions and billions of dollars planning and spending money to develop vaccines, and now we're planning, the president released his bird flu plan yesterday, his 235-page report that had all sorts of plan and contingency plans, 300 bullet points, as a matter of fact, for contingency plans for when the federal government shuts down. And, I mean, one of the points was even that they will farm out the production of our money to some foreign countries in case the Treasury shuts down. We've spent billions and billions of dollars, but yet, you know, as on a different topic, we can't do anything to close our borders, and we don't have enough money to do anything about illegal immigration. We don't have anything about the 43 million people in this country that don't have health insurance, but yet we can spend billions of dollars to try to plan for a random event.
And, of course, so what about Tamiflu? Was there any discussion about how effective this is? Do we really know if it really even helps?
It's absolutely not effective. In fact, the worst thing about Tamiflu is that it does develop rather early on in its use. It develops a lot of resistance. The virus becomes very resistant to it. It shifts the protein antigens on its surface, and there's actually a potential for developing a drug-induced resistance to and producing something that's called a mutant virus. The mutant virus may actually be the antigenic shift that they're talking about that could, in the long run, cause this pandemic.
Yeah, and of course, the thing is, we're spending billions of dollars to get a medicine that may do as much harm as good. So we're going to be back here in just a moment with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny discussing the avian flu danger or contrived danger, or we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and Dr. Tenpenny's been on the front lines of the battle to try to educate people about the danger or non-danger of the avian flu, be that as it may. And she actually went to the first meeting of the avian flu pandemic. What was the official name of that organization you attended in Washington, D.C.?
It was the first national bird flu summit that was held February 27th and 28th in Washington, D.C.
And, of course, did they have a solution? The one thing that Dr. Tenpenny said was that many people in the World Health Organization were not saying if it happens, but when it happens and why they could think it could happen. I mean, the bird flu has been around, this H5N1, going back to, what, the late 1950s?
Yes, the first time that it was documented by the World Health Organization was in 1959 in a bird outbreak. I believe it was either turkeys or chickens in northern Scotland. There have been multiple outbreaks of it since then, and in fact, something that I found that was really very interesting is that there was a serum collected from rural Chinese populations in 1992 that indicate millions of people had natural antibodies to the H5N1, suggesting that they've been exposed and recovered without any additional problems. There have been thousands of people that have been tested in South Vietnam and in the Southeast Asia area, bird handlers who were handling sick birds, and they found that they had antibodies to H5N1, had either not gotten sick at all or had been gotten so little sick that they didn't even seek medical care. So, and then even in the vaccine trials, what they've shown is that when they inject the H5N1 virus as part of the vaccine, it stimulates very little antibody response. So that tells me that overall, through all of those millions of people and thousands of people and even a vaccine trial, that the virus doesn't do much in your body. The body just sort of looks at it and says, well, that's not a big deal, and I guess I don't have to get too excited about this.
All right, fine. Well, they've made some sort of a vaccine for chickens, haven't they? And have they been vaccinating an awful lot of chickens?
They have been vaccinating a lot of chickens, and the vaccines that they have been using have contained mineral oil. And I think that that's really an important point, because mineral oil that's been used in a vaccine, when you read it in the veterinarian literature, it says that that's what's called a non-metabolized oil, and it could render the meat unsuitable for human consumption. That's a vaccine we're using, that we're injecting the mineral oil into these birds.
And I think people have to understand that they also want to use very, very similar mineral oil, in human vaccines, so that they'll be more effective. But what it'll do to the humans, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Tenpenny was just talking about the vaccines that they are using on chickens, and apparently the vaccine that they are using on chickens all throughout the world, they're putting a mineral oil into it. Now, they put a mineral oil into it to make it more antigenic. In other words, it really boosts the immune response, because you don't get that much of an immune response from the vaccine. But by increasing the immune response using these mineral oils, you can sometimes make the meat uningestible. But what happens to the people when they do eat the meat? Do we have any idea, Dr. Tenpenny?
You know, I don't know an answer to that, Stan, and it's something that I've been putting some additional research into, even beyond the things that I mentioned in the book, because it just says off of the patent from the using the adjuvant that has mineral oil in it, it says that if mineral oil is used in the vaccine in animals, it could make the meat unfit for human consumption. And so I'm wanting to look into that a little bit further. But you've said that there's also an oil that they're talking about using as an adjuvant, which is what the mineral oil is we've been talking about, using as an adjuvant for the human pandemic bird flu vaccine. And the one that's on the highest priority for consideration is something called MF59.
Isn't that squalene?
That is the squalene-based adjuvant that was in the anthrax vaccine. And in experimental animals, 100% of the animals developed severe debilitating arthritis or lupus after they were injected with a squalene-based adjuvant.
Well, then why then would they want to put that in a human vaccine?
We have to really wonder, don't we?
We really do. And for anybody who doubts anything about this, there's a wonderful book we carry called Vaccine A. It's the story of the boys we sent over to fight for freedom in the first Gulf War. And so many of them came back permanently crippled with these autoimmune diseases. And, of course, those who had the problems all had squalene antibodies. But the government assures us they would never do anything like that. They would never experiment on our servicemen. But all the shot records have disappeared, or so many of them have. We'll pick up the story there, Dr. Tenpenny, because this is rather frightening. Aren't they talking about actually making a human vaccine with squalene in it?
They are, and in fact, there's one already being used in Europe called Flurad that is already being used that has MF59 in it. and they are using that as a trial, and they're trying to get it introduced into the United States with the squalene-based adjuvant in it.
And of course, we know that they used the mineral oil-based adjuvant in the 40s, late 40s, and I think 40,000 of our troops, and so many of them developed neurological problems and autoimmune disease. They finally discontinued it, but for years they experimented on our boys, destroyed their lives, and then they just shrug and, well, we'll try something else again. But they seem to keep coming back to that because it's a good adjuvant. Yeah, but it's like with so many things that, it'll prevent the disease but destroy the patient.
Yes, it really will. And, I've said as long as I've been involved in the vaccine research and trying to get information out to people and parents and even other doctors to say, what sort of damage are we causing here with these vaccines in order to prevent us from getting very mild other types of infections, things like chickenpox or mumps or even measles, and the fact that a few children per year unfortunately have serious complications with that. Why do we have to vaccinate 4 million kids a year with all of these vaccines because there might be 1,800 that may have an adverse event?
And, of course, the real tragedy is that a lot of these children get asthma. They get autoimmune disease.
Yep, diabetes.
Right, and, of course, we know that the incidence of autism and attention deficit disorders and all sorts of central nervous diseases are just exploding in America. And since they took the thimerosal out of the vaccines, at least here in California, why we've seen almost a 25% drop in the incidence of new autism. But, of course, they don't want to tell you that because that would mean that they've been doing harm to our children all the time, and they can't let the American people know the truth.
That's absolutely right.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your attitude towards the bird flu. What do you think is going to happen? Is this really a problem? Are we being scared to death? Or do you think that there is something going to happen? Well, the people from the World Health Organization say not if, but when this occurs, what are they talking about?
Well, they're talking about the fact that I believe that this is moving forward a global agenda. You know, when I started to write the book, Stan, I started with a couple of premises. One of the premises was, why are all of these advantages and special privileges being given to the pharmaceutical companies for developing this vaccine, and are we really walking down the road here to mandatory vaccination in this country? A second premise that I had was who benefits most, and who wants all of these chickens dead? Who benefits most by killing 200 million chickens and burning them and burying them alive? And the third premise that I had was, why does it seem that of the people who have actually died from H5N1, why is the highest concentration of those folks seem to be in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia? And those are the premises that I started from, and I started investigating all of those areas. To go back to the vaccine issue, I do believe that we've laid the groundwork for mandatory vaccination. And even though vaccines are, and vaccine legislation is done on a state-by-state basis, through the Bioterrorism Bill of 2002, Executive Order 13295 that was signed by President Bush in April of 2003, and then amended in April of 2005, of setting up the ability to give the Secretary of Health and Human Services the right to declare a national emergency and to recommend the use to administer vaccines and drugs to the general public. And now that the pharmaceutical companies have complete liability protection for all of their bioterrorism products, I don't think that the general public is going to realize that this is still a voluntary shot.
All right, fine. What was that executive order again?
It was Executive Order 13295.
13295. And, of course, was this sort of going along with this mandatory health Emergency Health Powers Act? I know this was what they were putting out and trying to get all the states to enact right after, 9/11. In other words, they used that to get this program through for mandatory vaccination, or at least trying to push mandatory vaccination, and to the point where the public health officer could seize your home, everything you had, in the name of public health. It was the most incredible intrusion on private property and personal liberty I've ever seen, but it was in the name of preserving the public health.
I think that this was probably an outgrowth of that. That came about, that was tried to be passed in October and November of 2001. Only 17 states passed it, and I think this was a ratchet up to the federal level.
Okay.
part of the executive order, the one that was signed in 2003, it said that the Secretary of HHS can issue a directive for someone to be quarantined under suspicion of exposure or the possibility that he may become sick. Now, how can you predict that?
Well, not only that, but I was reading the other day that they said that if the bird flu arrived in America, they were immediately going to move into all the flocks of chickens and start killing them even before they knew whether the bird flu was there.
And that's happened overseas, too. They have gone into places like India, they've gone into Thailand, they've gone into China, in eastern Turkey, and they see a couple of dead chickens or a couple of dead birds and automatically assume that it's because of the H5N1.
So they don't even bother to try to find if it is H5N1.
They don't.
Maybe they were just old.
Well, yeah, or it could be some other virus. It could be Newcastle's disease. It could be a variety of other types of infectious processes that infect these birds. And so they go in and start killing off all of these flocks and taking away their livelihood and the food to feed the independent small farmers. And then after the fact, and I've read this in the Indian newspapers, then after the fact, after they've killed off all of these birds, they have no way to support themselves. They have no way to feed their families. They go, oh, gosh, we found out it really wasn't H5N1 after all.
I mean, this is the most incredible thing that would happen over there, but they're even talking about here, starting to decimate the flocks of chickens, probably primarily those that are privately owned, because, of course, they say that, the big chicken producers produce them inside, so, you know, they'd be safe there. They wouldn't tend to get it, but anybody who has chickens outside, we're just going to have to kill them. Even if we don't know the disease is there, I mean, what sort of organized madness is this? And yet, they've so frightened the American people, a lot of them will go along with that.
And I think there's going to be more fear-based stuff. In fact, you know, after ABC airs this movie that they're doing next Tuesday night on the bird flu, I think the biggest message that I would like for your audience to take home from that and all of your listeners is to say, keep reminding yourself it's only fiction. It's nothing more than going to see a Stephen King movie, and the sole purpose of that movie is to scare you. Well, the sole purpose of this movie is it's fiction, and it's sweeps week right now, so they're trying to scare you. And there's so many better ways to promote America's health than selling sickness through this language of fear.
Well, the question is, why are they doing it? I mean, because the movies become our reality. The television programs become our reality. I mean, we've had so many major terrorist attacks in the United States since 9/11, but they've all been on television. I mean, this tremendous threat from terrorism, and yet not one major attack in the United States in over 4 years. What's wrong with this scenario?
So it really makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It sure does. But, of course, it really doesn't matter whether we have the attack or not. If you can create the perception by seeing it on television, then that becomes your reality. Everything is really a matter of perception. It's illusion and delusion, and it's just as good as a real epidemic or a real terrorist attack.
There was a really interesting study that came out of the Wall Street Journal. It was published in 2003 by a professor Lewandowski from the University of Australia. And it showed, they interviewed more than 800 people from three countries, Germany, Australia, and the U.S., and showed them a list of events and said, once you have heard it on the news, and if it's been retracted, and do you still believe it? And unbelievably, most Americans still believed what they originally saw, even if a retraction had been issued.
Well, it's just the old idea that Edward Bernays said, you know, our minds are molded, our tastes are formed, our ideas suggested, largely by people we have never heard of. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. And when we get back from this break, why, we'll be talking a little bit about her book and how you may be able to get it from her. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. We're talking about vaccines. Of course, we're talking about the bird flu. And, of course, as you went to this meeting, do you think the majority of people there came away a little skeptical as you were, or did most of them already, of course, fit into this category of saying, well, it's not a matter of if but when it's going to strike?
I would say there were about 250 people at the meeting, most of whom were researchers from academia, PhD types. There was a lot of reporters that were there. I would say that the mix was rather, and there were a lot of also people there from the public health department and planning and preparedness sorts of divisions of their communities or from Homeland Security. I would say that the vast majority of people walked away sort of saying, yes, this is going to happen and we need to go out and prepare. But there was a certain subset of people that were there that were constantly questioning and going up to the microphone and asking questions like, how can you say this is going to be? And why are we doing this? And you can't plan for a random event. And remember that there were two other pandemics. There was a pandemic in 1957 and one in 1968. And many of us in that room, myself included, were old enough to remember some of those years and to say, we don't remember people dropping over in the streets. We don't remember them shutting down international travel. And we didn't have UN and World Health Organization planning documents and billions of dollars being prepared for what was going to be the most catastrophic thing to happen to our society. What makes you think this is going to happen now? And the only reply that would come back is, well, we're just due. Well, we're overdue. Well, viruses are going to morph, and so it's bound to happen sooner or later, so we need to be prepared. And some of the people literally just sort of rolled their eyes. And I had the opportunity to go up and ask a question, and I said, and I'm a physician from Cleveland, Ohio, and in the human medicine world, most of the time if people get sick, if they get a cold or they get the flu or they get pneumonia or something like that, we sort of say, well, it's probably because something had happened and your immune system was suppressed, and because your immune system was suppressed, you were more susceptible to the effects of this virus and bacteria. I want to know if anybody from the World Health Organization or the OIE, which is the animal division of the World Health Organization, has looked at why these immune systems of these birds, whether it's the domestic chickens or migratory birds, are so suppressed that they may be more susceptible to this more aggressive form of influenza. And I addressed that question to the head of the OIE, and he looked at me literally with kind of a deer in the headlights sort of look on his face and shrugged his shoulders and said, nobody's really thought about that. And I said, well, there's an environmental component to this. Has anybody looked into the environmental toxicities that are contributing to this? And he said, nope, nobody's looked at that either. And after I had the opportunity to ask that question, I actually had probably a half a dozen reporters come up to me and start asking me questions about that line of thinking. I had several PhDs ask me to send them my reports that I have read from the environmental toxicology journals, because they said, I've been to these meetings all over the world. There is not one single person who's brought up either one of those questions.
Well, I'm glad you were there and keeping them on their toes.
Thank you.
It's sometimes just a little disconcerting when you see the level of intelligence of the people who are leading our public health organizations in America.
Yeah, I think so. Or the level of lack of intelligence.
I said that with tongue in cheek. I spent some time in the CDC during the time I was involved trying to fight the AIDS epidemic, and there were people there who I'm firmly convinced either didn't understand or were intentionally trying to make sure that we did not use standard public health techniques to save human lives. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. And Sherry, would you like to tell our listeners about your book and how they can get copies of it?
Well, sure. Thank you. I would really like your listeners to go to my website, which is Bird Flu Hype, Bird Flu, F-L-U, birdfluhype.com. And most importantly, because I think that what I post on that site gives people an entire other view of what's going on with the bird flu. I have daily updates that are there. I talk about the environmental impacts, about the connection with Agent Orange, about the agribusiness agenda, about the pharmaceutical agenda, the World Health Organization. There's just a wealth of information there to show you that there's another side to this agenda. And on that site, you can also order the book, and the book's name is FOWL, F-O-W-L, and the subtitle is Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think. And I think I feel that it's a compendium of all the information that you need to know the other side of the story about the bird flu.
All right, fine. Now, of course, you've done a lot of work on the effect of the vaccines, and I think that's really so important, because if something should happen, whether it's real or imagined or contrived, then they're going to want people to take vaccines. if knowing what you do now, and if they say we've got a great vaccine, you know, roll up your sleeve, everybody should be vaccinated, we've got to get the public vaccinated so this doesn't spread and kill a lot of people, what are you going to tell people?
Well, I would say as long as you have the right to refuse, use that right. This vaccine is not going to be any more helpful than what the annual flu vaccine is, and that doesn't protect people either, and that's well documented. It's not going to do any good, anything to make you well. In fact, it has every potential to make you very sick. The problem that I have, Stan, that I'm really most concerned about is part of this bird flu agenda is pushing forward the whole concept of the national ID card. And I'm very concerned that the enforcement arm will come down on the side of you have to have proof of vaccination in order to get a driver's license or in order to get on an airplane or in order to travel across the state lines, because now they're going to have stewardesses at the airport being able to screen passengers to tell them whether or not they can go on the plane. And so, but if you've got your vaccine card that shows that you've been vaccinated, well, then that's perfectly okay for you to travel. So I'm really concerned. Now, I've not seen that anywhere. I've not seen that in writing. It's purely my hypothesis from all the things that I know and all the things I know about the national ID card that could very well be the enforcement side of making the vaccines come, the mandatory vaccination come into reality.
All right. Well, now, what is the danger? I mean, we're told that, you know, vaccines are safe and they're effective. And anybody who challenges that immediately is looked upon, you know, as some sort of a kook.
Well, after 7,000 hours of personal research into the problems that are associated with vaccines, I don't think I'm the kook.
I don't think you are either.
I know, but I meant that tongue-in-cheek in terms of what if somebody would say that to me.
Now, do you have another book on vaccines? I think you do, don't you?
I do, and actually I have two DVDs. There's a three-hour DVD called the Risk Benefits DVD that you can also order through that website. There's also a DVD that's called the What CDC and Science Documents Reveal that talk about the shoddy research behind the vaccine industry. And the other book that I have, it's called The Parents Manual, it's just loaded with all sorts of information and contact information. And there's an entire section, I think it's probably 10 or 12 pages of research, of references from conventional medical literature that shows you the problems that can be associated with vaccines.
And I think it's so important that people understand that there is so much information out there about the danger of vaccines, and your doctors really are unaware of this. In fact, I really was unaware of it when I was practicing medicine. It wasn't until I quit medicine and had the time to begin to read these things and found out that they contaminated almost the entire population of America with a cancer-producing virus with the original polio vaccine, and they've lied about that ever since then, and people are now coming down with these cancers, you know, mesotheliomas, and of course a lot of them, you test them, and they have this cancer-producing virus that has been passed down from mothers to their children, actually, and then there have been so many other things that they've done. They've infected this with all sorts of other animal viruses. I'm sure you've looked into all of that, haven't you?
Absolutely, and all of that's documented in the book, too, where we talk about the extra viruses that contaminate the vaccines. It's not just the flu shot that's in that vaccine. There's other things in there, too.
And there's other antigens and other things that can be harmful to you. And then, of course, they put in aluminum. Aluminum toxic to your brain. But it makes the vaccine work better. They put it on even though it damages the brain. And then, of course, the mercury, there's nothing more toxic than that, and they put that in the vaccines, too. And, of course, they're still putting it in the influenza vaccine. You're told it's out of the childhood vaccines. They don't tell you. They leave it in the influenza vaccine for the old folks and the very young and the pregnant women. And if you know anybody who's pregnant and they try to give her a vaccine shot, you tell her never to take that. We'll be right back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. And would you like to tell our listeners just some of the information you've come up with as far as the effectiveness of the influenza vaccine? Now, we've been told for years everybody should get the influenza vaccine, especially the very young, the elderly, and people have gone and done it. But you've actually analyzed what the scientific studies show about the, you know, the effectiveness. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? I think it's so important.
Sure. In fact, there's an organization that's called the Cochrane Collaboration. They're a research organization that what they do is they pick a particular subject and then they do a very in-depth analysis and evaluation of all the medical literature that is written on that particular topic. In 2005, all of the research that they reviewed was on the flu shot, and they came out with three separate reports. One separate report was analyzing the flu shot when that is now being recommended for children 6 to 23 months of age, and they said that it was, according to all the documented literature, there had never been a safety study done, and it was no more effective than placebo. Then they looked at giving the annual flu shot, to healthy adults, like in their 40s and 50s, and the reason that that's given is to help them to be well so that they don't miss work. Well, as it turns out, that the average day amount of work that was saved by not being sick from the flu was less than one day, so it was totally ineffective to give it to healthy people to keep them from getting sick from the flu. Then they analyzed it in the elderly population, and the reports that came out that said that the safety and the efficacy using the flu shot in the elderly population and the senior citizens was, quote, wildly overestimated, and that the runaway effectiveness of the flu shot in that population was just not to be seen. So we've got three different populations. They've looked at over 200 different studies from all over the world that involves more than 300,000 study participants. And in all three of those age groups, they looked at the medical literature and found that the flu shot was not effective.
Well, then why are the public health authorities assuring everybody that they should go down and get it, encouraging them to get the flu shots, and even sometimes stampeding them? You know, if you don't go now, why, the shots are not going to be available. You better get them right away. Before we run out?
Sometimes I think it's kind of like a scratch in the record. you know, the old 45 records, you get a scratch and it keeps saying the same thing over and over and over again. I think that we have just been learned, and we've just been told over and over again that the shots are safe and effective, they will protect you, and if you don't get your flu shot because you have this weak and horrible immune system that can't protect you under any circumstances, and of course...
Hold that off right there, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. And you really, if you have a chance, you should go to newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com. And she has a recent article that was posted there. And that goes into the... And you'll actually look on the left side of that website, and you'll see that she has a special place there where her name is listed. And get her article on the flu shot. And she has analyzed an analysis was done, an extensive, exhaustive analysis on the effectiveness of flu shots by an organization, and they spent a great deal of time going over all the literature, and they found that in children between 6 months and 23 months of age, given the standard influenza shot, doesn't do any good. For adults of 40 to 50, you give the shots to so that they are not going to lose time from work. Well, on average, if you had took the flu shot, it was probably less than a day that they saved from being off of work. And with the elderly, it didn't do any good. So those three groups didn't do any good. And yet, of course, they are telling you, you should get your flu shot. Would that be a fair analysis of what you said?
That was great. Thank you.
No. I see, some of the people were with us while you were telling me that. So I can look very smart because I just heard Dr. Tenpenny say that. Now, how can people get your material? Could they, for people who don't have access to the Internet, is there a telephone number they can call?
There certainly is. There's an 800 number where they can call and order the book. The number is 866-325-8633. You can call and leave a message on that number. It's actually answered during business hours, which is 9 to 5 Eastern Standard Time, but you can leave a number again, leave a message and they will call you back. The number is 866-325-8633.
All right, fine. And certainly we've watched Dr. Tenpenny's video. It's a DVD. It's really very well done. And I think that parents have to understand, or grandparents have to understand, that much of what we're being told about the safety of vaccines is simply unproven. Because if there were a problem, why are so many of our children getting asthma? I mean, what, one in six? So, isn't asthma almost epidemic now in our children, whereas it is not epidemic in many other parts of the world?
That's correct.
And, of course, then the problems with mercury, and there simply seems to be little question at all that the thimerosal, was responsible for this plague of autism here, and here in California, now that it's been taken out of the childhood vaccines. For the first time, as soon as they stopped using it, the incidence of autism began to fall, and now it's down almost 25%. But they cannot tell you that, because you'd begin to lose confidence in your public health service. You begin to lose confidence in your pediatrician, who tells you that, well, he just tells you what everybody tells him to tell you, and that is that these vaccines are safe and effective.
That's right, Stan. And, you know, you practiced medicine for a long time, and I'm still practicing medicine. And before we actually took the time on our own time, and because we were truly interested to look at that information on ourselves, were we ever taught any of that in medical school?
No, we certainly weren't. And we were taught that most of these childhood vaccines, childhood illnesses, the incidence of death from childhood illnesses had fallen dramatically. And so it had fallen, you know, I think 99% for many of these diseases, you know, from the turn of the 20th century, 1900, up until about 1944, 46, when many of these were actually introduced, introduced. And, you know, the incidence had fallen 93, 95% of death from these diseases, and certainly with measles. I think there were 44 deaths from measles in about the mid-1960s when they introduced it. But how much harm have we done from the measles vaccine? Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I think that we've done a lot of harm with the measles vaccine. I do think that the measles vaccine in and of itself takes maybe a little bit more blame than what it should. Because by the time the measles, the MMR, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine is given at a year of age, children have already had upwards to 50 vaccines before they get that one. They've had the Hib, the DPT, the polio, the Prevnar, and the list goes on and on from there. That there's multiple vaccines that they've already been given before they get the MMR. That I think that these children's immune systems have been crunched on and stomped on. That by the time they get the MMR and they inject that measles virus, and they're now coupling the live viruses with the measles, mumps, rubella, and now chickenpox, giving all of those live virus vaccines at the same time, that can cause genetic disruption in the child that can go on into the next generation. I think that the measles vaccine is a contributing factor. I think in some children it is the tipping point in terms of the straw that breaks the camel's back. But I think it's because the back has already been pretty much cracked before the MMR even gets there.
And, of course, these children will get an intense diarrhea. And, of course, many of them will start going into their autism. And actually, if you biopsy their bowel, you'll find out that there's actually live measles vaccine in the bowel that seems to be responsible for this. I'm sure you looked into that, haven't you, Dr. Tenpenny?
Oh, yes. And I go into a lot of that detail in both the parent manual and also in the DVD. The DVD on the risk benefits DVD talks about each one of these vaccines individually. And so if parents are concerned about individual things, they can cue it up on the DVD and just look at that particular one. They don't have to sit through the whole 3 hours to just find the piece of information they're looking for.
And I think it's so important that people understand what this is about, because, you know, if there is a tragedy, you're going to have to live with it the rest of your life. Do not rely upon the physician. Most of this information he is not acquainted with, and they will not allow this to be brought out at medical meetings. And the people who have done this, like Dr. Wakefield, one of the leading gastroenterologists in Great Britain, when he came out and told what he'd found, he was immediately attacked. He was actually forced to leave his prestigious position there, and people who tell the truth are not very, sometimes pay a tremendously high price. And I'm sure you probably know the story of Andy Wakefield.
Oh, absolutely. And what was so interesting about Andy's original research was that it was a case report. He's a pediatric gastroenterologist, and one of the things that those people do is colonoscopies. and he'd done a colonoscopy on 12 autistic children and found this interesting finding that they had all of these swollen lymph nodes in their intestinal tract, and on biopsy he identified a measles virus that he thought was from the vaccine. And he published that paper as a case report, which, you know, doctors have been doing ever since there have been medical journals, and didn't make any claims, didn't absolutely say, this is what I found. He said, isn't this interesting, and I believe this should be looked into further. And out of that, he became the scourge of the medical industry. It was like he picked up a stick and poked it in the eye of the giant.
And, of course, the giant fought back, and really, I think he's practicing somewhere here. In America, is he practicing medicine now, do you know?
I believe that he is in Texas.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, certainly the tragedy is if anybody speaks out against vaccines, they will be viciously attacked, and if they possibly can, they will, of course, make their lives very miserable. Have you had some problems because of your stance?
Well, thank God, no, I haven't. And I think that the reason why is because very early on when I got involved in this industry, one of the things that I was given great advice to do by Kathy Williams, who's one of the co-founders of the National Vaccine Information Center, she said, take all of your information from very reputable sources, just go to the CDC, use them as a reference, cite the references so people can go and look them up for themselves and see that you've not taken anything out of context. All the material is right there. Use all the conventional medical literatures to build your argument. And being a physician and being able to read through those hefty documents, I was able to do that. So it's a little difficult to be able to criticize my work because it's not research, it's not anything that can be torn apart. It's a review of the things that have already been written, and all I've been doing is putting light on the darkness.
And I think it's so vitally important that you do, Sherry. I think that it's so vitally important that people begin to challenge what we're being told, because look at our kids. One in six children in America has some sort of a neurodevelopmental abnormality. How could that happen? Is not happening. You know, in darkest Africa, they don't have problems that bad. They have a lot of other problems over there, but they don't have that problem. And a lot of children, when they come to America, you know, from underdeveloped countries, they start getting sick. They start getting pathologically obese. They start getting asthma. They start getting all of these other things. You have to ask yourself, is there something in our situation and even in our medical care that may be promoting it?
I think that there is a multiplicity of layers of problems. I think some of it is environmental, with the pesticides and the chemicals and all those things that are in our environment. I think a good portion of it is our diet. I mean, you know, like Asian and Japanese women have a very low incidence of breast cancer until those women come here and start eating our diet. And then their incidence over a generation becomes the same as American women. So it's more than just genetics. I think that the high fructose corn syrup in terms of obesity. I think that there is a lot of things with the white sugar and the refined carbohydrates that we do. But I always go back to say that I know that there are a lot of different contributing factors, environmental, dietary, genetic. But what happens in America to American children first is as soon as they are born, the vast majority of these children are subjected to the hepatitis B vaccine within 48 hours of their birth while they're in the hospital. And I believe that that starts to break down the immune system and lays the background for which things like the environment and pesticides and on can cause more damage.
And I really think that what people have to understand is the vaccinations are not a normal infection. They put in these adjuvants in them to make them work more efficiently, to challenge the immune system, and they mobilize the immune system, and since it's not a normal mobilization as you would get with an infection, it's an artificial one. Many times this inflammation just continues on, and then you get another vaccination, and that stimulates the immune system. Have you run into that theory and this idea and the impact on the brain and on the developing brain of the child?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And considering the fact that most children's immune systems do not start to fully develop until they are about almost 2 years of age, by the time kids are 2 years of age, they've had almost 60 vaccines. And also that during that period of time, while they're supposed to be developing their own innate immunity to be able to recognize something that's foreign versus recognizing their own organs, that whole system begins to get disrupted. And I think out of that becomes autoimmune diseases. I think that there's just an enormous amount of things that we're doing to break the back of the next generation's health. I've said, often in jest, but with some element of truth, that it appears as though they're either trying to kill us all or make us customers for life. With what they're doing between genetically modifying our food, between what's happening in the environment, what's happening with pesticides, and what's happening with these vaccines.
Well, I think that people would be well to heed what Dr. Tenpenny is saying, and especially when we see, you know, all of this propaganda now saying we're going to have another major epidemic and you're going to have to be vaccinated for it. In fact, we have to have herd immunity. We have to have everybody vaccinated so that nobody's going to get the disease, because if you're not vaccinated, you get the disease, you might begin to spread it. So you owe it to everybody else to take the vaccine. The trouble is, if it has squalene or some of these mineral oils in it, we know what has happened to the people who've used those in the past. They've developed these autoimmune diseases, and we know that at least a third of the veterans of the first Gulf War are ill, and maybe more. We don't know. The government certainly isn't going to tell us, but many of these people will be crippled for the rest of their lives. We certainly lost over 25,000 of these young, healthy men for some reason. And the government doesn't want to go into that. And do you think that if they really had been using experimental vaccines, they would admit it?
Well, never. I mean, why would anybody ever do that? I mean, after all, don't they all say, hi, I'm from the government, I'm here to protect you.
Right.
I'm all about the American people, and I'm representing the American people. And you just keep wondering, well, which, you're not representing me, which American people do you think you're really representing?
Well, I think of one of our listeners, if you'd like really to get an incredible medical story written like an adventure, but it's really all true. It's Project Daylily, written by Dr. Garth Nicholson. I recommend that to our listeners. I think it's well worthwhile. Well, once again, let's get the names of your book and, of course, your DVDs and your web page and your telephone number out.
Okay, great. Thank you, Stan. I mean, the book is called Fowl, F-O-W-L. It's available at www.birdfluhype.com. It's also available through Amazon.com. If you don't have access to the internet, you can call and order that through a phone number of 866-325-8633. I have another website that's drtenpenny.com, and out of that, off of that site, you can get all of the DVDs, the parents' manual. You can also get the bird flu book there. But there's a lot of information that I think that people should have in their armamentarium to be able to be fully responsible and make informed decisions about their health.
And I think that's one of the hardest things for people to do. Sometimes it's so much easier to say, well, you know, just let the doctor tell me what to do. Unfortunately, you are responsible for your health, and if there's a mistake made, you're going to have to live with it the rest of your life. And doctors, good people, they really are. They wouldn't intentionally help you, but they're never going to read in your medical journals, and they're never going to hear at the medical meetings much of what you're going to hear from Dr. Tenpenny and from many of the guests that we put on. So I recommend that you evaluate both sides, and then you make an informed consent. Unfortunately, they do not give you an informed consent. They do not tell you of all the damage that can be done to your child in the nursery when they immediately want to give them a hepatitis B vaccine, a totally unnecessary vaccine. Why do they want to give them hepatitis B? I mean, this is the disease that's spread only by sexual contact, by blood contact. If your child is going to be a homosexual or a drug user or a prostitute, then I certainly strongly suggest that you give it. But, well, of course, you're going to have to repeat it again in a few years anyway, because it only lasts for a few years. I really wouldn't suggest that you give it under any circumstances.
There you go. That's the right message.
That's right. So what do you tell people about the hepatitis B vaccine? This is the greatest scam of all time.
It most certainly is. In fact, I've made the statement publicly before, and I would be more than happy to say it again, that if I were independently wealthy and I didn't have to work to make a living and see patients and for the rest of my life, the thing that I would do would spend most of the rest of my days campaigning against giving that hepatitis B vaccine to children at birth. It's the most neurotoxic vaccine that I think has ever been created. It is totally unnecessary. If they really felt that it was necessary in hepatitis B in mothers that had hepatitis B, which I'm not convinced it's necessary in those children either, which may be a topic for another time. But let's just suffice it to say that hepatitis B screening should be part of prenatal care. And if mothers are hepatitis B negative, there is absolutely no reason in the world for those children to receive a hepatitis B shot at birth. None.
But it's a rather expensive shot, my understanding. It costs a fair amount of money. Somebody's making a lot of money out of that.
Well, of course they are. I mean, the vaccine manufacturers are always claiming, always crying the blues and saying that, you know, we don't make any money in the vaccine industry. It's almost like charity work for us. But the truth of the matter is it's a $10 billion a year industry. I'd like to say that my company would make that much money and call it a charity.
And I would point out simply that if you look throughout the world, in the underdeveloped or third world, 100% of the people have hepatitis B, or have had it. Now, and every child has. Where did they get it? Why did they get it? From the vaccine shots using dirty needles. How could you do something that stupid unintentionally? We have the CDC statistic, World Health Organization. Almost every child in third world countries has hepatitis B, and they got it from using dirty needles. Gee, you would think that maybe they could use spend a penny for a clean needle instead of dollars and dollars for the vaccine, or maybe there is another agenda. We're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up today's program. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Dr. Sherry Tenpenny is our guest. Sherry, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Okay. I think that it's really important that people know that this whole thing is based on fear, and that before the government employs all its instruments of national power, including quarantine authority, as the National Strategic and Pandemic Influenza Plan declares, that people need to know their rights, they need to exercise their right to refuse, they need to understand that health is about taking care of your bodies, and that the germ theory of disease has been flawed from the beginning.
I see. Well, you mean you don't think that the germs do cause disease?
I think that if you are very healthy, you take good care of yourself, you could be swimming in germs and it wouldn't cause you a problem.
What you're really saying is, of course, what you need to do is keep your immune system active and up and
exactly.
Eat right. And of course, doesn't diet have a tremendous amount to do with that?
Oh, absolutely it does. And I think that, you know, there are some supplements that I think people may want to know about when this bird flu pandemic arrives in the United States, as they're telling us it will. Things like colloidal silver, things like olive leaf extract. Sambucol is a great supplement you can get from the drugstore. Sambucol is made from elderberry extract. They've actually done some research showing that it is effective against influenza viruses, and including the H5N1 virus. Iodine topically on your skin can help to kill off viruses and bacteria. Colloidal silver is a great thing. It's been around since the 1920s in terms of fighting off viruses. You don't have to be afraid. You can take care of your health and don't buy into the government fear and their agendas.
Well, I think that they're doing everything they possibly can to scare us to death, and we're really going to have to wait and see how this whole thing pans out. But you will be going then to this next conference there in July?
In June. Uh-huh.
Well, I hope maybe if there's anything, that you'll be writing an article on newswithviews.com so we can keep abreast of what you learn.
I certainly will.
And for our listeners again, you can find the articles at newswithviews.com. That's Dr. Sherry Tenpenny's articles there. She writes regularly. It's a wonderful website. Great articles there, and it certainly will keep you abreast of so much of the thought of some of the outstanding authors we have across the country. Again, newswithviews.com. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Stan. I greatly appreciate it.
Bye-bye, and God bless you. Okay, that's Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and of course, I hope you enjoyed her appraisal. Now, there are lots of people, good people, honest people, who really believe that we are facing a major pandemic, and I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know one thing, and that they're scaring us to death, and the thing is that when you're scared to death, you don't think effectively, and you might very well take a vaccine that could change your life forever. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's the primary means by which we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day. So if you believe there's really a problem and you'd like to join our team, our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, and certainly our web page is www.radiolibertyfamilyofsupporters.com. RadioLiberty.com. Now, let me mention that we have a lot of great information up there on the webpage. We do actually offer the a complete testimony of Dr. David MacArthur before the House Appropriations Committee back in 1969, where he asked Congress for $10 million to create a new, entirely new disease that had never existed before, that would destroy the immune system, so there'd be no immune response to this. And as he said, some people think we shouldn't do this because it would be another form of some mass killing, but we want the $10 million to do it. And 10 years later, the first cases of AIDS appeared in San Francisco in people who had taken an experimental hepatitis B vaccine, and 75% of those young men who volunteered for take this experimental hepatitis B vaccine, 75% of them came down with AIDS, and most of them are dead. Same thing happened in Africa when they used, in the areas where they used the experimental hepatitis B vaccine. That's exactly what happened. Now, that's not the hepatitis B vaccine they're giving to your children now. That was the initial vaccine, the one that I believe had the virus in it. Now, then, of course, we would simply suggest you get the National Security Study Memorandum 200 put out over the name of Henry Kissinger. We offer that. And there they tell you that the major problem in the world is population. There are too many people. They're going to have to control the population. You need to get my DVD on planned population reduction. And you'll see the pictures there, the Georgia Guidestones, where talk about, getting the population, world population down to 500 million. They're talking about eliminating over 95% of the world's population. And of course, then we have a video on population reduction. We have a 4-tape set on population reduction. We have a 4-tape set on why do we still have cancer, and a 4-tape set on genocide, and all sorts of information you need to know to protect your health and the health of your family. We carry the book, Emerging Viruses, the story of where the AIDS and the Ebola and the Marburg virus came from. And then, of course, we carry the book by Dr. Garth Nicholson, which we strongly recommend, Project Daylily. That's Project Daylily. His story of he and his wife as they came under tremendous pressure, and there were attempts on their lives because they were investigating the origin of Gulf War illness and chronic fatigue syndrome. Chronic fatigue infects about 2 million people in America. Now, that's chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia together. Another million with Lyme disease, which of course developed at Lyme, Connecticut, just across the river from, just across the inlet from genetic modified warfare center there on Plum Island. So, anyway, the book, Project Daylily, fascinating reading. I'll tell you what, I couldn't put it down when I first got it. And then, of course, what can you do to protect yourself? Well, you need to get Dr. Russell Blaylock's book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. You need to learn how to build up your immune system, and we're going to be putting out a health catalog as soon as we get all the material together. It'll be available, and the recommendations that we make and what we do ourselves take to try to maintain our health. You're going to have to look after yourself and after your family, because unfortunately, if you do exactly what you're told, you're going to end up like so many of the young men who went off to fight for freedom in the first Gulf War, and of course are chronically invalided today. And let me ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.